Standing Committee of Finance last week, indicating that they had some sort of discussion on this matter, and they felt that we should convene some sort of an engagement with the AG. And as a result, we invited the Standing Committee on Finance, we invited the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, and we are here ourselves as the hosts. We've received acknowledgements from all the committees, and I'm sure that by the presence of Honorable Gordy, at least Scopa has received it. And we did get an acknowledgement from the Standing Committee of Finance, so we are going to continue. You will, honourable members, recall. Okay, honourable. Oh, before we even get there, yes, we'll get your apologies, but let's get to honourable Singh.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues. On apologies, apology of honourable Sangwa, who serves on Scopa. He unfortunately had to fly back to Durban on urgent matters.
All right. Yeah, whilst we're on our apologies, can we deal with the apologies from our side? We've got Honorable Mente, Honorable Carter, Bengu, and Makahla from our side as apologies. I'm not sure, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. I must say that, yes, my comrades were not here except for one that the staff were still pursuing. have unfortunately had to tender apologies because of business that had to be attended. But I'm confirming that this was communicated to us and we had communicated to, with all our members to be here.
Thank you very much. If we deal with that, can we carry on with the business of the day? It's being Friday. I know that my comrade in arms, Singh, and I, that are migrant workers, want to leave early. No flights, yeah. Honourable members, as I was saying, Comrade Chair, we received we interacted with the Chairperson of Finance, who raised the matter that they had had some discussion, AG, in the committee. And I thought it was appropriate that we afford you an opportunity to deal with this matter in this committee, because this is the committee that is tasked with ensuring that the AG is, or there's an environment for the AG to operate that is free of any contamination or free of any insinuations. So really it's an opportunity, AG, for you to indicate to us and to South Africans what informed your decision to do what you did in relation to Nkonki and also with KPMG. I do know, honourable members, that the AG did send out a press release, which I think we've shared with you. So I'm suggesting we allow the AG to talk to us. And having spoken to us, we then can engage with the AG. Just to indicate, AG, you're probably aware of it, not just here, but outside there's all sorts of panic, maybe, or questions that what you've done may be a knee-jerk reaction, or it might be unsympathetic or irrational in as far as it would relate to employees, specifically of Nkonki. I'll allow Honorable Gordy, whether it's now or later on, to give his own views as your major customer, in a sense, to give his views. I have my own views, but I will summarize it, allow you an opportunity to talk to South Africa and to the committee, and members of the committee will obviously engage with you where it's concerned. So, Chair, I'm not sure if you want to discuss it, if you want now or later. Later, okay. Is that okay, honourable members? We allow AG. I'm not sure how much time you need, AG, but it's quarter past nine. Can we agree that at the absolute latest, at 10 o'clock, you'll be done? I don't know how much time you need. And then after 10, members will engage with whatever the input is, and then take it from there. Over to you, AG.
Thank you,
Thank you very much, Chair. And good morning to the Chair of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts and honorable members present. Let me at the outset, Chair, welcome on behalf of all of us at the Auditor General of South Africa the opportunity to interact with yourselves on the matter pertaining to our action that we took on the 17th of April regarding the audit mandates that are extended to both KPMG and Ngonge Incorporated. Chair, as I begin my briefing to the committee, I would also like to once again say that as the Audit Office of South Africa, we made a choice way back that due to the size and the timing of our audits, meaning that because government reports at the end of March for national and provincial departments and entities, as well as at the end of June for local government and related entities, it became inescapable that we would seek the support of private audit firms in carrying out our work. We've done our modeling of the organization with that background in mind. To the extent that at the last count, we have no less than 90 registered audit firms that do work on our behalf, ranging from the one person that runs their own practice in the Northwest to the big ones that also do the audits of listed entities on the stock exchange. That is the breadth of entities that we use in the audit office. And Chair, these arrangements that we entered into with all of these firms have spent more than 20 years almost ever since we had embarked on the professionalization of this office. And so what was meant to be signed by us in terms of Section 188 of the Constitution is allowed through Section 43 of the Public Audit Act to be handed over to another firm to do the work and sign the report on our behalf. So those are the legal instruments that we often look to. The fact that we are allowed to secure the services of another audit firm with certain requirements that we often look at in order to qualify them in the database of entities that do work on our behalf. And this work that many of these firms, as you know them, do, ranges from what they help us in municipalities with, as well as what they help us with departments and entities, the ones with the March year end. As I said, Chair, among others, we have based our relationship with any one of these firms on some very specific fundamental principles that we normally confirm as we contract this work out to any one of these firms. If I may just quickly cover any two of these. One of them is the independence of the institution that does this work on our behalf, because we are ourselves required to be. The next one, requirement, is to do with carrying out this work with professional competence and in accordance with the auditing standards that we adhere to. In addition to this, Chair, we also contract these firms also on the agreement that they will stringently follow our auditing standards and methodology, barring certain differences that may have been identified between ourselves and them. In order to satisfy ourselves when this work gets delivered, We also superimpose internal and external quality assurance processes to make sure that nothing is left to chance when it comes to the finalization of opinions and matters that are of significant relevance for oversight. If I look at all of the two, the issue of independence as well as the professional competence with which this work is carried out, it speaks to the credibility of the product of the audit. In order for the audit product to be regarded as credible, it must at a minimum at least have those two key pillars underpinning it. We say this because an audit conclusion and a service that you provide in an audit is not a physical good that moves from one person to another. It's a product that is based on trust. That's the fundamental principle. Hence, the issue of independence and professional competence becomes the underlying feature to ensure that there is trust in the product presented between the auditor and the person who is using the product of the auditor. That is just by way of background, just to cement the context in which we operate, the context in which we renew, the context in which we stop acting with firms that are found to be wanting in respect of one or two of these. And Chair, when we look at our situation as an audit office and we go back again to Section 188, it instructs us that we must audit everything effectively. It sets out clearly that it says you must audit everything with the exception of those things that you yourself cannot do with your own hands. That's effectively the framework that we follow. So everything is then departments, their entities, the state-owned entities, the municipalities, the provinces, only with the exception when we decide, as allowed by Section 4.3 of the Public Audit Act, to opt out of a particular audit. During April 2018, Chair, we took a decision in the office to terminate the contracts of both KPMG and Ngondi Incorporated in doing work for us in the public sector. And this, and I'm going to reflect on the circumstances now that led to this decision, as well as the implications of this decision. Let me start with KPMG as the first part of what came up in September 2017. I think members will recall around 2017, there was a document titled KPMG South Africa Leadership Changes and Key Findings Arising from KPMG International Investigation. That was the heading of the document that was released in September 2017. On the back of this report, it pointed to what appeared at the time to be a breakdown in the risk management and audit practice disciplines within KPMG. Let me say that again. This particular report, which I referred to, which was released by KPMG International, drew attention to what appeared to be a breakdown in the risk management and audit practice disciplines as practiced by KPMG, a contracting firm that we contract work to. The firm itself, KPMG, reflected on the allegations that were made in this report and confirmed at that time, around September last year, a series of leadership changes as well as processes that they had embarked on as an effort to enhance their own governance systems and quality processes. And they also committed themselves to a number of independent investigations. Most relevant for us were the investigation that was undertaken and announced by the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, IRBA. Another one was an investigation that was what is referred to as the Nsebeza Inquiry, which was sponsored or done on behalf of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, investigating various matters on the back of what came out of this report. We then took steps around that time ourselves, our own initiative, to seek an engagement with the leadership of KPMG, because now the leaders that were running the institution had gone and there were new people that were put in charge. Coming back again to that key foundation, what we wanted to understand in this engagement was that, having understood what we read without passing judgment on it, can you help us understand whether the matters that were raised in that report were a mere aberration, meaning that they were just isolated in those identified areas that were a subject of the report? Or were they indicative of a systematic breakdown in the risk management and audit practice disciplines within the KPMG environment? That's the question that we asked. We were given assurances that the partners of the firm continue to be independent of the audit entities they audit. This was at that time in September. And that they strive to improve on their oversight processes while they recognize the seriousness of the weaknesses that were identified in that report. We said, okay. Because we don't know the answer as to whether this is just a mere aberration or is this now a systemic encroachment into the risk management and practice disciplines. So we said, let's wait and see what those two investigations are going to come up with. But in the meantime, Chair, while we were making that call, we said, we will continue to secure the services of the audit firm KPMG. This was in 2017 when we made this decision in September. Subject to the outcome and the conclusion of those investigations that had commenced, which will better inform us as to whether we are in a place of a mere isolated matter that cropped up, or are we seeing these things popping up in other places in the institution? Because we think that if we don't have an answer to that question, we would not know how it has impacted on our independence, if at all, or how it has impacted on the practice disciplines that ensure that the value of trust continues to be unshaken. In the meantime, while all of this decision was taken around that time, work was not yet done for the current financial year, because when the matter arose in September, they had already signed off on the previous year, which is normally the end of July. So from our side, we felt there is some period to wait, because clearly the reports that will bear their signature, should there be a risk, are the ones that will be in respect of the 31 March 2018 year, which will be signed off on the 31st of July this year. So we took the decision knowing that we are not at risk, at least, because those reports will be, which will be subject to an audit conclusion by them, are still to come. And they're still to come because from September to now, the cycle hasn't ended. It only comes into fruition at the end of July. So that was the grace that we thought we could give in that context. But the action at that time came with what I might call an early action, if you like, in September 2017, where we said, instead of allocating you this work now for a two-year period as we do that interval with other firms, yours has become an annual allocation to be subjected to a review process as the undertaking for the investigation gets concluded. So that was a step taken to bring to their attention that the audit office was not pleased with the fact that it was not able to get the answer to that matter. So we were interacting with them to pursue how far you're going, how are things. That was happening all in the background in the meantime, because we had made an undertaking that we do not want to find ourselves in a place where we have to contend with these reports, regardless of something that might have popped up, which is much riskier than what we saw in September. Fast forward to April. We're still waiting as far as KPMG is concerned, and those investigations that are being undertaken by IRBA and SAICA, as we all know, are still in progress. And as we were making inquiries also with them, we discovered that they also are not too sure as to how long it will take, especially as far as IRBA is concerned, because they were saying as they look into one area, they start picking up something else. And then they look elsewhere, they start picking up something else. And our view was that this is going to become a nightmare for us, because we have to concur and to agree with the conclusions that would have reached, but we still have this cloudy environment that no one is going to spring up an answer to very quickly. And so it happened in April that around KPMG came the matter of VBS Mutual Bank, which threw to light much more serious matters than what we had identified, at least from our point of view, in respect of two partners that were responsible for the signing responsibilities on the VBS Mutual Bank, who, based on the reports that were issued as well as the interactions that took place in the public domain, had also inappropriate matters of conduct that were identified insofar as their actions were concerned in VBS Mutual Bank, the bank that is now under curatorship. But it also threw light into some other matters pertaining to the book in that bank, where there was no verifiable evidence for certain transactions. And so our bewilderment in looking at this pushed us into a situation where we had to have conversations with the leadership of the institution to say, while we were waiting to figure out whether the matter that came up in September was just a mere aberration or was it now a systemic breakdown, here pops up another instance in a different environment within the practice of the firm. And so we thought, therefore, in order to minimize the risk to the audit office, the best for us is to take the decision to withdraw the mandate to perform audits on our behalf until those very significant questions become answered. That was the step we took in respect of KPMG. 7 months was not a waiting game in isolation. It was a waiting game informed by the fact that you need to get to the answer in order to determine. But the answer just came anyway from a different place while we were still waiting for the outcome of an investigation on those matters. And so we felt that we will interact with the leadership of KPMG and inform them that we have now decided to withdraw the mandate for them to perform audits on our behalf. Coming to, that took me 15 minutes, Chair. Let me deal with Ngongi incorporated. Let me just upfront say that as far as one looks at the KPMG matter, we crafted it in looking at the entire journey and the matters that confronted us as an action taken because of a systematic breakdown in the risk management and audit practice disciplines within this firm. That is the firm conclusion that we reached in evaluating matters associated with that service providers. It had to do with our assessment of the systematic breakdown in the risk management and audit practice disciplines, which have a direct bearing on issues of trust when it comes to the reports signed under their name brought to us. Let's deal with Ngongi one. On Ngongi, Chair, and let me just make the point up front clear on this as well, that media reports to us are also a source of that risk information that we use and process in order to assess different levels of exposure. Some of it comes from people that we speak to in the entities when we interact with them on updating the nature of the business and all of that, so that the risk management alertness of an audit office is an ongoing and a recurring process. Whether it comes from the media, all we do is not to act on the fact that we saw it in the media in isolation. We see it there as a trigger, and then we seek a conversation with the people that are in charge in the entity to do a verification of the facts, as well as to assess whether they are of the same page as the matter that we ourselves had read. Now, the matter that came up in the media regarding Ngongi, Chair, as I said, they are also part of the package of these more than 90 firms that do work on our behalf. It dealt with issues of shareholder transaction involving Ngongi Incorporated, and this prompted a reaction from our part to see whether there is any exposure to us as an audit office on the back of this information that had come to light in the matters and the reports that were thrown in the public domain at the time. Now, this one, if one looks at it as a prompt for the action, it is to do the one from Ngongi with an independence matter with glaring risks that may compromise risk management and audit practice disciplines. This one is an independence matter, and I'll demonstrate how it comes across to us as that independence matter which may have a direct bearing on the risk management disciplines and practice management in the Ngongi environment. One of the questions, Chair, that we wanted to understand, and there's a lot of detail in many parts of what has been published in the Amabongane exposés and all that, but what stuck with us was to understand whether the new shareholders that had taken the significant shareholding, as we had seen in those published reports, whether they were registered auditors or not. That's a question that was of interest to us. Because one of the key elements of independence for an audit office is written in Section 38 of the Audit Professions Act, the Act of Parliament that replaced the Public Accountants and Auditors Board, Auditing Practitioners Act, Section 38. This Act stipulates that the only firms that may become registered auditors are, one, partnerships of which all the partners are individuals who are themselves registered auditors, or sole proprietors where the proprietor is a registered auditor, and or companies where IRBA must register such a company as a registered auditor only if individuals who are registered auditors are shareholders of the company. The operative word here is registered auditor. That's what we are after here. We were not after all the other doom and gloom and other things that are reflected in that report. Of course, as auditors, we have to inform ourselves as to what could be behind some of those issues that are raised in the report, which I'm sure will be a discussion for another engagement. But for us, in terms of the purposes of our pursuit of this engagement, was to establish who are the outside shareholders that have now taken a significant stake in the entity. Are they registered auditors? Because the law says that anyone who has got the authority to sign that report, which has to happen on the back of a trust relationship, must be a registered auditor. And there are many requirements for anybody to get to that point. Like us, who are registered auditors, take some steps that are sometimes involving sleepless nights to get to that point, as a matter of course. So that's what we wanted to establish, so that when we receive these reports, at least we can be assured that the people that examined the detail that was being audited, which gives rise to whatever the report may be, have subjected themselves to the disciplines of a registered auditor. It's unlike the quality of fresh bread. You can see it as they bring it to the counter. But this one, which triggers a report, which expresses an opinion on fair presentation or otherwise of financial statements that have been subjected to an audit, goes much deeper than just accepting that there are new shareholders which are not known. So we extended the inquiry to the leadership of Ngongi on these matters as to who and what is the identity of this new shareholder. And there was a stark response: we were not involved in matters pertaining to that transaction. This is now us getting the response from the leadership that is there now. So, Chair, because this answer hinges on deciding whether there has been a departure from independence as we know it or not, it becomes an even bigger risk than a breakdown in the systems of risk management and practice discipline, because it is at the heart and at the core of what an independent auditor is expected to do and why it must be a registered auditor who is a shareholder of that entity, whether they are a partnership company or individual. Now, this prompted, Chair, the action to interact with the leadership with a view to making sure that there are no aspersions that are going to be cast on the opinions that may be issued under circumstances where the shareholder of the audit entity is not known. That's really the firm stance that we took, was that we would be reluctant to subject the audit of the entities under the name of an entity where they themselves do not know who the new shareholder that has a significant interest in the ownership of that entity. In addition to that, to try and be fair and assess whether there is anywhere else we can get this evidence, we were also informed by the leadership that they had recently undergone what is called a firm level review which gets undertaken by the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. We understand that that particular review was completed, but the final report had not yet been generated. We just wanted to have sight of it so that we can maybe satisfy ourselves as to whether there is any matter that had sprung up from the independent firm level review performed by IRBA. We were not successful in laying our hands on that report. So we didn't know effectively who's now the owner of this firm that we have entrusted such huge amounts of work, including the nature of the risk of the entities that we had assigned to be signed under their name. The saying to us, Chair, that we are going to investigate, we are trying to secure mandates with legal firms to do an investigation of this matter, which is a transaction, from what I understand, that arose in 2016. We're now in 2018. We still do not know, but we still want to investigate. So we understood that, well, we can understand the need to investigate the circumstances surrounding the transaction, but we do not know what you want to investigate about a factual matter pertaining to who is this man or woman who has now taken a shareholding in the entity subsequent to the shareholder transaction. That one is unlikely to be what you think you want to investigate after having said you do not know. But we can accept the fact that there may well be all sorts of circumstances that surrounded the transaction which fairly you might need to go away and investigate. Now, we are in April as all of these things are happening. The one coming from September, the other one popping up recently. Remember, the one that pops up recently has got a major risk pertaining to issues of independence. We've got end of May, this May, where all the annual financial statements according to the PFMA must be handed over to the auditors to be audited and signed off. And then the auditors must audit for the next 2 months, even though they may already have started in doing the preliminary audit work already from last year. But statutorily, all of them must report by the end of July. So we took this into account in looking at what options we have available in the light of these outstanding matters that will result in investigations that will add to many other investigations that are out there in many platforms where things are being investigated. But I'm sure, Chair, you will have the experience of many investigations that commenced, but very few whose final outcome was ever announced. That was some of the risks that we had to think about. To what extent is there the likelihood that any investigation commenced now to determine who the share owner is? How long is it going to take, and what does it, why is it not known after a year and a bit as to who the new person owning this company that we are now running as an audit practice with a requirement for that shareholder as set out in the Audit Practitioners Act. Jay, in all of this, as it is happening, we are also aware of the horrific incidences that have been reported in the public domain with regards to matters of conduct of auditors. We, as the auditors in the public sector, are not insulated from those matters, let alone the fact that what happens on the private sector side as it impacts on our outsourcing strategy hits back at us directly. Because it is possible that someone who is subjected to the rigorous audit processes of the Auditor General might find a gap to question us on the integrity of an opinion that is issued in an entity where there's a litany of public information pertaining to the lack of independence in that entity, and begin to paint us with that brush as an audit office. And in other things that we do, Chair, we are also required as an audit institution to defend and protect the independence of the audit office, because that's probably one of the few things that it has to give the level of credibility required of the audit that it issues. And so that discipline and that character, when we look at it from our perspective, we also want to see it in those that do that work for us, because we can easily become implicated and tainted by people who think that we're looking the other way when some of these things are happening daily. So those are some of the key reasons that prompted us to act the way that we did. So the announcement to both of them was on the day, the 17th of April, after we had done this assessment on these two different cases, but affecting people with the same professional profile, in essence. And I'd like to repeat that. It's decisions whose risks emerged at different times, but have a devastating impact on us, regardless of the fact that one happened 7 months ago and another one happened recently. And the underlying theme in looking at it was the independence of the audit office is sacrosanct. We will rather be found not having executed something with the level of diligence required and can still correct it. But I think the members will appreciate that when that perception of lack of independence goes away, the credibility disappears, and the trust associated with that credibility in the reports also disappears, and we can never pull back a possible downward spiral that could result from that. And of course, for us, this is a 107-year-old tradition that has been cemented in this institution, and we thought that let's protect this. And we know there will be consequences when we do. Now, since the decision to terminate the auditing contracts, we have been working very closely with both affected firms to pick up the pieces, in essence, because we've taken a firm decision to ensure that we cement that two pillars of the audit office. But we know that it came with some casualties in the process. And the reason for us to interact with these firms was to say, at the time that we took this decision, your audit processes were still underway relating to the sign-off for this year. One of the things that we would not want to compromise is the audit quality that comes out of the remaining work that needs to be done up to the end of July, as well as to minimize the disruption of the audit process, because to hand over an audit of a 14 million assignment, for argument's sake, from one group of auditors to another within 2 months from the sign-off date can spell disaster in the process of making sure that you promote proper oversight over the audit and make sure that the conclusions reached in the audit are not made by people who are not thoroughly informed about the entire risk process. This comes from one of our international standards on quality control, ISQC-1, which deals with matters of quality control in an audit, but it also comes from the risk management disciplines that we use in an audit generally. That it is preferred that a person or groups of people that commence an audit at the planning stage should ideally be predominantly the same people who prevail over the evaluation and conclusion of the audit evidence leading up to issuing an audit report. Because the nature of the issues we deal with in an audit are an iterative process of risk review, risk assessment, going back to the risks that we have dealt with in the team over the period of the 12-month cycle. So it can't just be a case, okay, these ones are gone, give it to these ones. They can cause a train smash, especially to some of the institutions that are with complex instruments and other things, which some of these entities were responsible for. So, Chair, the cooperation that we had sought then with them, firstly, was to ensure that we secure the audit quality, but also to try and minimize the impact that could attach to the professional staff of these firms. Because in both situations, we were of the view that the decision and the steps that we had taken were not a judgment or a pronouncement on the capabilities or integrity of the professional staff of those organizations. That was not what it was about. It was about exactly the two issues that I raised up front, threat to our independence at the level of the shareholding transaction, as well as a systematic breakdown in the risk management and practice disciplines in both of those two entities. So we felt that it was never our intention to make anybody stranded, but there was no doubt that this was going to come with a consequence, effectively. So we are currently aligning ourselves with them to make sure that at least come 31 July, those audits will be signed off with a level of scrutiny, quality assurance, and reviews that are often associated with the type of audit work that they were expected to deliver. What it meant for us was that we will have to make available some of our people to reinforce the staff that was already working on these assignments. Now there are three categories. I'm going to use the next 10 minutes to 10 o'clock to finish off. We have assessed the different categories of audits that we have assigned to them. And all our executives are busy interacting with their corresponding partners on the other side to work out a seamless transitional process that will ultimately end up, at least for this period, with those audits signed off by the Auditor General. Having done the supervision, the additional review work, and other activities that will enable us to get to that point. Now, if you look at one of the categories of audits as an example, we have what is called Section 4.3 audits. These are audits where we have opted out and where the firm is appointed in its own name by the auditee after consultation with us. So we have to concur on the appointment once the appointment is made, and that particular firm, in terms of Section 4.3 audits, will then sign off the audit report in their name. What we have done then is a consequence of this step, because we are not the direct appointer, but we concur. Inconsistent with a step to withdraw the mandate for those audits that are assigned to them, we also decided to withdraw the concurrence on the appointment of these two firms as external auditors, proposing that the AGSA opt in as external auditors, as per the Public Audit Act, in consultation with the accounting and executive authority. So the effect of this, therefore, is to then make these audits contracted in relationships for purposes of signing off the 31 July financial statements. Still consistent with what risks have we identified, what steps did we take, and what are the subsequent measures to make sure that the step that we have taken does not disrupt the natural flow of the reporting system. So this implies that the professional staff of these firms will continue to be involved in the audit work as originally envisaged, while the necessary review, quality assurance, and sign-off responsibilities will be handled by the AGSA. So that's one category in respect of those Section 4.3 entities. You'll find in the list of entities that I'm talking about the likes of your National Housing Finance Corporation, DENEL, the Development Bank of Southern Africa. Those are the entities, among others, in addition to the contracting in relationship that we have entered into. This transitional arrangement, Chair, will only apply to audits that need to be finalized by the 31st of July, and audit arrangements for any audit cycle beyond this date will be confirmed shortly after the completion of these audits in consultation with the auditees, because they had the first bite at making the decision as to who the appointed auditors are going to be. We then had to embark on these transitional arrangements to make sure that they don't compromise the outcome of the final audit process. However, we're going to have to go back to them after the sign-off of these and engage them in the light of where to from the 2018-2019 year onwards. There are some that may not be as hectic because one of the service providers was doing the last year in respect of the term of their contract on this particular assignment, and that one may well be an easier one to deal with because the entity was already gearing up for initiating a replacement process. There is at least one notable exception to the above, Chair, and that relates to audits of a couple of universities and TVET colleges that were handled by KPMG, and their financial periods were year-end 31 December. At the point when we took this particular decision, those audits were already far advanced, and the final sign-off on them was imminent. We then decided that, at least for that confide, it's about three or four of them, at least the risk is not that wide in terms of its pervasive nature. We've then said we will allow them to finalize these audits because they were saying they will be signing off as arranged with the auditees by the end of May. However, we will still have to step up to make sure that we do the final review processes, even in those ones, in engagement with the partner who will be responsible for them. Most of them are done in our regions. For example, some TVETs in KZN, others in other provinces and so on. But there's about three or four of them. Now, on the way forward, just in the last few minutes that I have, Chair, the priority of the AG is now to closely work with all the interested stakeholders in a quest to further improve the confidence that the public place on external audit function in the public sector. We've already taken some steps on our side, and we are busy in consultation. Among these steps is an effort that we are putting into pulling together a roundtable engagement at a minimum with all those firms that do work on our behalf in the public sector, so that we can begin to allow them the opportunity to address the problem that we all confront, so that there's nobody who imposes the solution to this, because these are professionals, many of them have been on this journey as auditors for some 30, 40 years and all of that. Huge numbers of experience, but the unfortunate thing is that when certain things are happening, they tend to paint everybody with the same brush. But there's no doubt that there's still a need for a stronger public sector audit orientation if one looks at the kind of risks that we have emerged with in the most recent past. So it's a painful thing that has happened in the sense that it had to deal with very specific issues in specific places. But we believe that there are many opportunities available for us as an audit office, working with the profession in general, to endeavor to mend the image of the auditing profession. If you don't have this independence and this professional competence with underlying ethics, then we've got nothing as auditors. There's nothing else that we have. It's only a green pen and a piece of paper, but without those two things, we've got nothing. Because everybody is going to begin to genuinely think that you are the wrong guys if you don't stand up and do something about it. And so we also think that the leadership here in Parliament, our auditees and the audit firms in the public sector as well as in the public in general, will find it in them to somewhat embrace this decision. We know it comes with lots of uncertainty for many, but we think that it is a critical step towards restoring confidence in the value of auditing in South African society in general. And if some would not stand up to reassert the centrality of these disciplines, we have made a choice on our side to do it. So in conclusion, Chair, we thought that between independence and professional competence lies the solid foundation that will protect the sanctity of the AGSA, at least for many years. And we did not want our audit products to be associated with the matters that were flooding the public domain with little, if any, reaction from those to whom these allegations were directed. Because we are on the receiving end, and if we don't ask the questions, we may be asked those questions directly ourselves. Again, Chair, the credibility of the audit reports lies on how the auditor versus the user of the audit report trust what has happened. And once shaken, this credibility, or questioned, the trust tends to go away, and the consequent effect of it would be the loss of public confidence and trust in the work that we do. So we are currently finalizing the schedules to realign and reorientate the audit work that we're doing. And significant amounts of commitments have been made by those firms, and we thank them for being accommodating under the circumstances. But the reality is that some of those people, if they need to quickly decide about their futures, may also make decisions that will also impact on the smooth conclusion to the end of July. But we do have some contingency plans that we have put in place to address that matter should it become our major challenge. So, Chair, I think it's safe to return the chair to you now.
Thank you very much, AG. Honourable members, you have it. Let's open up for questions of clarity, not only questions of clarity, quite honestly, for your comment. What is your view? You can ask for questions of clarity, but ultimately, as this committee, we must take a decision of whether we support or we don't, and if we do, how do we defend it in the public and also with our colleagues in Parliament, and if we do, how do we defend it? So this was intended to empower us to take a decision, but we can ask AG for questions of clarity because I thought they were very clear. But let's recognize Honourable Singh, number one, Duvazana would be number two, and then we've got Honourable Ntombela, you've been away so long. Ntombela, number three. Kuno, you'd be number four. Adams, do you want to say something at this point? Adams will be number five, and then let's see if we need to have a round two. But let's start with the Honourable Singh.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the AG for the presentation. Well, let me start off with your last question. What is our view? Well, let me say my personal view and the view of my party is that we believe it was very necessary for the Office of the AG to intervene in the manner that they did. I think public perception and the actions of both firms, KPMG and Nkonki, would not have allowed us or the office of the AG to do anything different. So to that extent, one supports the action. But having listened to the AG carefully, what I'm sensing is that this was a quote-unquote temporary intervention. And that they are working with these companies. Because you see, there's a difference between brand name and individuals. And within these companies, there are highly competent, trained individuals. Within Nkonki, for example, we see there are about 180 of them that have been mentioned. Now, I don't think that South Africa and government should lose the expertise of individuals because of the KPMG brand or the Nkonki brand. And I'd like to know how one is going to deal with that moving forward, separating those things. Second question, Chairperson, is, having read yesterday that, Barclays have severed ties with KPMG, reaffirms my position, on behalf of my party, that we did the right thing. We seem to be in good company in that regard. And there are other companies that are using, other corporates that are using some of these firms that are also considering their position. So that's just to justify that. The Auditor General, in his written statement and now, spoke about other firms that are being investigated to see whether or not there's also the element of risk management and audit practice discipline that they're not complying with. Could we be told who those firms are if it's not going to compromise anything? We don't want to know the nature of the investigation. And then with KPMG and Nkonki, are there any audits that you are looking at as the office of the AG that they may have done on your behalf that could have had an outcome that may not have been very kosher? Because we know of other firms where that has happened. They've produced audit reports only to find that, you know, those audit reports were very suspect, and I won't mention that firm. And my third and final question, Chairperson, is that should we not see this as an opportunity, as the office of the AG? See, they say you must look for a seed of hidden opportunity in every adversity. Where we as a committee have recommended that the office of the Auditor General should in future start working towards auditing all state-owned enterprises. That's a decision of Parliament. Not only of our committee, it was endorsed by Parliament because of what has happened in state-owned enterprises. Is this not an opportunity now of probably using individuals and enhancing the capacity within the Office of the Auditor General by having some of these individuals to do this kind of work directly for the Office of the Auditor General and not through these 90-odd private firms that you are using? Although there may still be a need for private firms to do some of the audits. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Coaches. Coaches, I agree, Chair, with the decision taken by the AG South Africa. The main reason why I am agreeing is the way they've analyzed the whole situation of what has happened between the very same two companies. Indeed, I agree that it was a systemic problem or breakdown of these two firms. However, though, we have to remember, Chairperson, that if you remember the 2008-2009 recession, especially for the Saxon world, which is UK, EU, and others. The main questionable entities or body that time was the regulatory behaviors which had interests not helping, not identifying the conflict of interest between whoever party that is in conflict. As a result, the world then shut down. It is for this reason, Chairperson, that I am really, really appreciating what has been done by the Auditor General SA, because it has worked within its legislative framework. Chairperson, I'm really concerned about an independent regulatory board of auditors. I'm really, really concerned. I am assuming here, it's my assumption, there is the conflict of interest. What did they do up to this far, up to where the Auditor General says there is a problem here? How do you keep on saying I am investigating? How can you investigate when the law of this country says every services that are outsourced, that entity has to declare to the stakeholder the ownership, who owns this firm, the shareholding, the equity, the capital of the firm? How come that the independent regulatory board do not function within its regulatory framework? Don't you think, Chairperson, as the legislators, we do have the right to call them? They need to account to us. They can't just work like they've got so much power to do it, because I am assuming, I would want to say again, there is the conflict of interest for the mere fact that they seem to, according to the AG's presentation, they do not partake. There's no assistance that has been provided thus far. Instead, there are more of a view that actually the AG is more like having some hyper decision that actually you have taken. This is I'm reading the situation. You were not supposed to do that. You were too harsh. No, you were not. For the mere fact that they keep quiet. Some legislative, some law here has been broken. Some confidence of the investors has broken. Some confidence in the public has been broken. We are saying as legislators, we're fighting corruption. If now that confidence, it goes up to that level, can you see the damage that is being done to us and the country itself? It is therefore critical for us as this committee to call the IRB to tell us, where were you? What are your findings? For years, annually, for years, you couldn't pick it up. What are your reports saying? Secondly, Chairperson, I hear what the Auditor General is saying about, you know, when you have terminated the relationship, Chair, there is no way there's going to be trust and honesty. In the first place, it's not the leadership that is doing the work. It was the staff of the KPMG and the Ngonki. Now, if we have terminated, the AG South Africa has terminated the contract on the 17th of April, but the AG says, okay, continue, let the staff continue, but I will make sure that signing for quality, for assurance, it will be done by my office. No, termination is termination. Cut off, that's it, finish and clear. I know that it's going to be too much for on their side because of the personnel, because of the number of the people that are, but let's terminate and cut the ribbon. It's finished and done. It is done. So I'll be uncomfortable that we're talking about the, like what the original said, quoting the ISQC, Chairperson, if you have compiled the data and I must try and pick up some quality and I must pick up some relevance and whatever within that, do you know that you can do it in such a way that you have been dealing with me for years, you know my weaknesses. You can put it in such a way that I sometimes miss that. So I don't know at what level really, because if it goes up to the level now of when the AG signs, I've got a serious problem with that. Unless the AG says, yes, there is the work that I've already done, but I'll make sure that for July preparation, I'll make sure that some of my staff, I have to shift, and some of my staff, they have to go there and be hands-on before it even reaches his office. Then I'll be comfortable with it. But what has been done by the Auditor General, what has been done by the AG SA is correct, it's right. If you say, was it within the right time frame? I think it was, because, you know, when you delegate with trust, you delegate with honesty that people are going to do that, especially professionals that are being guided by particular some legislation, that they will do it correctly. But I am very worried about the IRB. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, well, that's just wrong. Honorable Ntombe.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairpersons. Chairperson, I am of the view that the Auditor General took the necessary steps under the circumstances. If one has to consider the reputational damage that could have been caused if that office did not take the proactive measures. So I support the move so far. However, I've got a couple of issues that I want to be clarified on. The Auditor General speaks of the ample time that those offices were given. I would like to know how much time is ample time, and is it within the acceptable standards of, that is, in the acceptable standards of audit practices? What is it that we call ample time? Chairperson, I would have appreciated if the Office of the Auditor General provided us with some form of correspondence between the offices concerned, that is the KPMG and Gonki, so that one is able to gain a better insight as they respond to the probes that or to the inquiry that the Office of the Auditor General was doing. I'm saying that, Chairperson, following the comment of the Chair, that we need to defend this. So we need also to get a better understanding of what exactly transpired between those offices in terms of their correspondence. And I would like to know, Chairperson, lastly, before taking this decision, that these are the steps that are going to take against these two offices. Did the Office of the Auditor General inform them prior to say, now that you did not comply, or now that you did not respond to 1, 2, 3, these are the impending actions that we are about to take? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the opportunity. I agree with the Auditor General that we cannot inform our decisions because of what's happening in the public space, because if we do that, we're going to have a problem as a country. Then it means we are acting irrationally. We have not applied our minds. We want to be part of the public space. But Chairperson, before I can even start with my questions or my comments as well, I want to say that we have a long way dealing with transformation in our country. It's a serious problem, and we are sinking when it comes to that. You know, as the Auditor General was presenting the media release or his presentation on Gonki and KPMG, I was trying to Google the black auditing firms. And there are really few. And I was asking myself, what are we doing to really work with them and help them? Now, I remember our first conversation or the first meeting that we had with the Auditor General at the beginning of the term, asking him how is he going to incorporate the black firms to be part of auditing or helping them with the audit. And he said in that meeting that he is committed towards that. And it's not only his job as the Auditor General, but I think it's our duty as well as South Africans to make sure that there is transformation and everybody gets to be part of the economy. If we really are serious to make sure that we're bridging the gaps, and I don't think we are anywhere near that as South Africa. We're not bridging that gap. Instead of bridging that gap, we're getting it worse and worse and worse. But that's my comment, Chairperson. But also, Chairperson, what I wanted to ask, you know, I'll make an example. 2 weeks ago, we had SAA. Is it 2 weeks ago, Chairperson? We had SAA come in before us. And throughout the years, I'm not sure who was auditing them before the AG took over in auditing them. But they were okay. I mean, their books were all fine until the Auditor General got in and dealt with all the matters that were there. And they are in the situation that they are in because of the auditing firms that are outside of the Auditor General's office. Why I'm saying this, Chairperson, is because I really do not see why do we need to have auditing firms. I know what I've said before about transformation, but I also don't see the reason why do we need other auditing firms except for Auditor General South Africa. My contribution would be, why don't we try and beef up the AGSA and make sure that they have enough auditors? If we really want to bridge the gap of, I mean, trying to take all these people who are, you know, your PricewaterhouseCoopers, all of them, all of those players, because, you know, the entities that come before SCOP, the entities, the departments, most of them that have been audited by all these firms have problems, and serious, serious problems, problems that we are finding ourselves, it's difficult for ourselves to actually get out of it as a country. They are ill-advising their departments because they want to have more contracts. They tell them what they want to hear. But as opposed to the AG, because he doesn't have, I mean, to him it's not about profit making, but it's about working for government. Then it becomes easy because he will then help to beef up those particular entities and departments and make sure that they do a better job. So I would suggest, Chairperson, that maybe it's about time again that we talk about the organogram. See where, as COEG, can we help in terms of making sure that there's more money that gets into the AG South Africa's budget to make sure that they actually get more auditors instead of all these firms, because Chairperson, you are also a member of SCOPA, you know exactly what I'm talking about. All these departments and the entities that have not been audited by the AGSA are in dire problems, and we really need to sit up and say, this is enough. We have to make sure that the ills that we are talking about, the corruption that we are trying to curb in South Africa, we are really taking it seriously. And there's no way that we can take it seriously if we do not beef up the AGSA. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Adams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm giving my support to the AG, the decision that the AG taken. I think they are doing the right thing according to Section 38 of the Audit Provision Act stipulated. I thank you.
One question, I don't know why did I forget that. The credibility of audit reports, that you are that the AG is going to spend time on from KPMG and because I think this is going to consume more time. And my question was that, because I really need to understand the rationale of us having to have other people coming on board, the time that they're going to spend trying to make sure that that there's credibility and there's authenticity with the reports, where are they going to get that time? And what's going to happen to the contracts contracts that they already have, or other audit things that is before them as an entity? When are they going to do that, if they're going to be checking all the credibility of those firms? That's why, Chairperson, I was saying that really we need to find a way of helping them. But again, Chairperson, what I wanted to ask the AG is that the budgets or the contracts that you have with Ngonki and KPMG or any other audit firms, if you should terminate their contract, what then happens to the budget, your budget? And what's going to happen really? I just need to understand the rents and cents about that. And does it really make sense? What are we going to do about it? Thanks.
It's 25 past 8. Can I give you 15 minutes to respond to these questions? Would you? And then Comrade Gordy, you will then engage after that with, if you need to engage. If you could respond to those. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much, Chair. And once again, I think a common thread of support from the honourable members. We certainly are welcoming of those sentiments. And the point, honourable thing you raised regarding the rest of the professionals, we've already had some conversations with some members of the profession and other firms who have also made a commitment to come to the party with regards to not allowing those professionals to be stranded and not accommodated in completing their training. Because the reality of this is that among these professionals are people who had just signed up for their articles. Others were towards the end of their articles. And in terms of the regulations that govern these training contracts, they need to have a minimum set of hours in order for them to sign off. Otherwise, all those 2.5 years that they had invested will go to waste. That's the kind of damage that is being discussed in order to limit it, among others. Because it speaks also to the question of why do you not just walk away from all of them. We felt that from an ethical point of view, it may be a significant problem to actually accede to. We can't easily walk away from them because others have signed up for their own qualification, because part of the steps they've got to go through, many of those individuals, including the ones in our firm, in our office, is that they must study, then they must be exposed to a real working environment through articles, which has got a minimum period, I think, of 3 years, getting exposure to various elements of how the auditing world works and other things. Now, those are the people who, in the context of Ngonki that would, has applied for voluntary wind down, would be affected because they will be left in the street and there will be very little they can do about it, which compromises their ability to qualify, some of whom were close to qualification, but also will disrupt many that had already embarked on this training and this career. And the point we are trying to isolate those matters is to say, let us also weigh in and take responsibility to deal with what has happened as a consequence of this action. So the members of the profession, including the Institute of Chartered Accountants, have started a process to engage with this matter so that we at least save that part. As far as other firms, Chair, the reference to that was largely the stuff that's already in the public domain, not necessarily investigations that are being pursued by us. But what we have done on our side, because of the numbers of contracted entities that we have, we are also stepping up the proactive assessment of these risks among the many that are in our database, so that if we find something faulty, we at least can take proactive steps to address it. So that is really the reference to that investigation. I'm sure you are aware of a number of the others that are reported on frequently in the public domain, which are not investigated by us, but by the rest of the other bodies in the profession. What it's done in the past, Chair, when we said the pronouncement is not so much on the professional competences in carrying this work, we were informed by the fact that we do, for those audits that we ship out, we do our own final quality assurances at the end of these audits, and there's nothing in those audits that was found to be faulty, insofar as the fact that they were signed properly. An opportunity for AG to audit all SOEs. It is an opportunity, Chair, as you say, as you have correctly said, Honorable Singh. And the reality is that when we look at this, we also often look at what are the economics of this thing when it actually gets put into practice. And when I said, take an example in our office, there are 3,500 of us. If we had decided not to contract out some of the work, it would have meant that, I'm just using a hypothetical number, that we must possibly have another 1,500 or 2,000 people, as an example, spread across different places, because the total value of this work that we contract out is somewhere between 450 and 500 million in value. To walk away from something like that is quite a mission, because in order to do this work and deliver it diligently, you need different levels of people that are trained to do it, right from a partner to a senior manager to the trainee accountants to the manager to the supervisor, and the necessary tools that are required to interrogate the big data that comes from entities like, for example, your Eskom, your Transnet, your Tenel, all of those. Those are huge assignments. It will take some doing to realize an aspiration like this, but I don't think that we are blind to that issue. Ourselves, when we look at it, we say, if it was important or it was necessary to do all of them, because that 450 that we pay out to those firms, somebody can argue that, but it will be available to pay the salaries of those extra 2,000 people should you employ them. But the reality is that if you look at the total quantum of audits that we do in the PFMA, they are somewhere around, let's say, 380 odd reports. Added to that is the local government with some other 400 odd reports every year. It is possible that when you have those people, you're going to have to finance their existence, both in infrastructure, the tools, their salaries, and everything. Now, there's one peak period which reports around July, and once those reports from July are done, then the system goes into quiet mode. And then the provinces pick it up again via the municipalities, because the municipalities are not done at the center. You could face a situation where the bulk of these people that you have created a fixed cost around will continue to exist in your environment because of the labor regulations. You can't say you've signed off the reports, now go away, we'll employ you next year. They'll still have to be there, and the huge amount of money that will have to be carried in order to support their existence, including salaries, will probably be disproportionate to what a costly or a cost-effective audit could amount to. So if you look at the strategy that says, let us determine what component or portion of work could be done by private audit firms, is taking into account the fact that we've agreed the total hours and the rate that we will pay you as an outside audit firm. But you don't have to worry about your accommodation and living costs and other benefits and everything else. All we know is we trust the fact that you are going to do a diligent enough job for the quantum of time and professional competence required to do it, so that at least we don't have to have this bulging cost of keeping people who may not be busy, because there's no other financial year. Some private audit firms survive this because different audits that they do, others end in February, others in March, others in June, others in September, others in December. So throughout the year, they are able to spread their cost base in respect of those people who also happen to do other stuff, which is possibly non-audit as well. Whereas with us, we are confined to doing these audits in these statutorily determined dates. And when you're not busy, the question will be, but what are we paying for those instances where we are not busy? So we are looking at it from that point of view as well, as a cost-benefit arrangement, as a cost-benefit analysis, but at the same time to tap into the skills in the profession that have been built over many years. Because we were in a situation not long ago ourselves where there was hardly any chartered accountants, as an example, to speak of in the audit office. Not so long ago. If there were 20 in the early 90s, there were too many. We're now sitting with somewhere around 640 chartered accountants signed up as staff in the office. So some of these possibilities are there now, but we can't go for a big bang because it will cause some serious problems in the environment. And of course, our growth over these years, we also recognize, was on the back of the support that we got from the profession when they stepped in when we couldn't. And I think it almost is a quid pro quo to say there is something that the profession can contribute to this if we sit down and make sure that we're all of the same view about what the public interest associated with auditing in the public sector is about. And I think if we can push that orientation, the public sector is not going to spend much money by trying to get the right stuff. It will be the influences that we bring to the table to those that normally would have taken this work as just a balancing figure for them to meet overheads. It's only when we sit down and say, hang on, remember there's a public interest in the work that we do. Have you made sure that certain steps have been taken to mitigate that risk? I think there is an option there. But we take the point that a lot of these, once they are handled through the office, there's normally some immediate benefit on them. And we'll pursue it, but with a level of responsibility to other things we cannot control. Then the issue regarding the continuation of staff and why don't you terminate and cut off, the point that Honorable Dubazana raised. Let me just illustrate this with, especially in the transition period. Let's take an example. There's an audit based on the information that we have gleaned as well as our contract work schedule. The audit of Denel is budgeted around 45 individuals, seven of which are partner-level people. We don't have those people in a bank ready to be put into an audit, for example, of Denel. Even if we had them, it would have been extremely difficult to get through the rigors of an audit of that nature. It's budgeted from a cost point of view somewhere around between 12 and 14 million rands worth of audit fees. Because of the complexities of the activities of the institution, because of the arrangements and the structuring of the business operations, the ability to understand the business operations and translate them into how does the accounting system manage all of these complex projects and things that are multi-year, some of which are also historical, and the fact that you also have not had large numbers of stability in some of these institutions. Looking at an audit in the next 2 months of that size, giving it to a completely new team will probably be, I think, the most difficult thing to can do. So when we instituted this transitional arrangement, was also to call on them to realize that part of the responsibility an auditor has to assume is the fact that there is work that has to be finished. We will put, as we said, other people from our side as well, just on the last point that you raised, as to whether we will include other people from our side. We did say that we will include other people from our side so that we can help reinforce with the work that has to be done. But one of the principles that we've also agreed with them was that an agreed fee that has already been negotiated is not going to be affected by the fact that we must put in additional resources and some of those. because then it shifts the burden for the cost to the ODT. But at least to get to the final year-end sign-off, we'll try and make sure that we work with increasing the resources but maintaining the fee so that we don't have to burden the ODT with additional cost because of this step. So there will be a continuation of those people. As I said, those seven partners have got different responsibilities because they are also subsidiaries and divisions that they need to look at within the context of a complex design in terms of how the reporting structure is and how it works. So Chair, then that issue of not necessarily cutting off with the professional staff, because it will benefit, it's a win-win also. Some of them will benefit from the fact that it will give them the hours that they need to get to the completion of their work. But one of the things we want to safeguard is that we don't want to find a situation where after these audits are finished, some of them, for example, have disappeared into other pursuits, and then we sit with having to explain issues that we, who may have come in at the tail end, may not have enough insight about. And that's why we don't want to do that change in that way, at least for the 31 July. Beyond that, the staff goes back to the drawing board to say, ODT, who do you think, based on your own assessment, you would like to appoint as your auditors in this context? Or some of them may decide, well, we would like to pursue it ourselves, or what do you advise? And we'll take that into account, considering the fact that there's a pool of professionals who, based on their work over the years, have been involved in these audits and may be interested and keen to continue on them, depending on who is doing that particular audit assignment. It may be of benefit for them to, for the remaining year or two that they need to finish off on those assignments. And others might want to become managers and senior managers on those audits going beyond. So there is a potential there to work through an absorption of some of that talent so that we don't throw them away. But at the same time, we don't do an irresponsible thing, because the 31 of July date will come, and the dates have already been set for the likes of your audit committees of these entities, as well as other governance bodies who are waiting for the reports to be presented. And that's the part that we thought this transition is supposed to address. If it means that it must address it with limited disruption of the audit teams, that's what we had opted for, because we thought it would be the right approach to take. Chair, then, coming to the questions that Honorable Ndombela raised regarding ample time, how much is that, and as well as issues of correspondence? I think we can share some correspondence in respect of this. But ample time, Chair, was, in our view, based on the fact that we were raising the issues of principle with them, and upon raising them with them, we had waited for them to go back and find the answers. So I'm not too sure in terms of who is an owner of this share that has been sold in 2016. And the question is surfaced at the beginning of April 2018. When the answer is still, we were not involved, we do not know. I guess the issue of the ample time must be looked at in the context of that question, as well as the risk that continues in the absence of a clear answer to that question. That's the view that we took. So we did not have an administrative process where we said, let's give them 7 days before we can take this step. But it was largely informed by, but we were asking a question about who owns this new share and all that. And that's where the issue came from, in terms of, it's enough time once we ask the question and at least you go away a couple of days after that question has been raised. Did the AG inform them on these actions? Yes, we did. And we did that on the 16th, if I'm not mistaken, of April, where we met with each one of them and communicated based on previous discussions that we had. And then at those engagements, we said to them, colleagues, you would perhaps better understand the predicament that we face, and this is the step that we will be taking with regards to our audit mandates come tomorrow. There was a question about why do we need other firms to do this work. I think I've covered it. It is a delicate matter. It won't go away, honorable members, immediately. We know that there's been many people who express themselves on this matter, but we also want to make sure that we can weigh in on our caution, if you like. If we can succeed in cautioning the lack of haste in dealing with it, I think it'll help a great deal. But we do appreciate the fact that there's a need to raise the bar as far as work that is done in the audit in the public sector is concerned, and we will try and manage that situation in that context. Beef up the AG and position it to do this. I think, as I replied to the question earlier on, we have in a number of instances. If you look at the entities that we audit now, we did not have them 10 years ago, many of them. We did not have the SA Express audit 10 years ago. We did not have SAA 10 years ago. We did not have SAFCOL 10 years ago. We did not have the likes of Petro SA and others as well in that period of time. So there is a gradual trend towards embracing some of these audits. And some of them were invited by the accounting authorities and the executive authorities to take on those audits. And over time, I think all we need to do now is to make sure that the assurances that come from this contracted work cannot be questioned because of issues of independence and lack thereof. And then the part of the credibility of audit reports, is it not going to take time? The plans are already being discussed now. If one looks at some of them, for example, it's a question of the audit team from the audit office having to satisfy themselves over a limited number of areas. So they're not going to weigh in on the entire file from the planning of the job right up to its final evaluation. They will identify and spot certain areas that, from a risk point of view, are likely to be exposed when it comes to conclusions on fair presentation. And those matters are normally based on discussions that happen with the current auditors and our guys. So the time will be limited, but I think it will be much needed to make sure that we do not leave with audit conclusions that we cannot explain should somebody ask the question 6 months later. So that is the extent of the intervention. It's not to overhaul the thing. We would prefer, though, that those people who are working on those assignments do whatever it is they've done right up to the present to complete those assignments so that we can have a fresh engagement about where to from here with their oversight structures. Chair, I think those were some of the questions, barring the ones that I tried to answer globally. But maybe coming to the issue of the transformation from the points that Honorable Connor raised and black firms and commitment. Our commitment to promoting transformation and the black firms in the system is not shaken by this. We are still committed to making sure that we work with quite a number of them who are in our database. Some of them, because of their size and their growth, are experiencing significant amounts of work assigned to them. So we definitely are still here to make sure that that part of the profession continues to survive. But as I say, now that we have what we have, there's obviously going to be an enhanced level of rigor in applying our oversight over that database and make sure that when we do work with a particular firm, it does not have other assignments in that environment where we have given them the work, where they are performing non-statutory audit work, as an example. So it is about lifting that issue so that we're not caught by surprise on those matters when we deal with them. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thanks very much, Auditor General, and thanks to comrades for their inputs. Even questions were actually inputs because they were pointers. I must say that, Comrade Chair, we, from our side, we fully appreciate the fact that you had created this platform so that the Auditor General can, you know, have the opportunity to clarify Parliament on the steps that he has taken beyond the media release that that we have all seen. And I'll say from the onset, Auditor General, reputation is everything. Defend it with your life. So I think if you use that as a starting point, it would assist. Secondly, I think the auditing profession has not covered itself in glory in recent times. And I think what has thus far happened is almost like things have just been happening out there and there has not been anything done or said or action taken. We were all helpless spectators. And I think the fact that, at least from your side, there is action taken, and today you are here in Parliament, talking to Parliament and also to the nation about what you did, why, and actually giving us the insights of what transpired, I think that is very helpful. You recall that when the KPMG issue arose last year, Scopa, we called them. And the basis of us calling them was because they work with you, they issue audit reports. What reliance, what confidence should we have on reports that come from a company that has a question mark? Because auditors give you skills and confidence. But when the confidence is gone, what else do you have? Nothing. So it is a serious matter. And even when we met with them, we were not satisfied. And I must say that personally, I was not happy with your response then. But in my engagement with some of your staff, I understood that you probably have a responsibility to act with some caution. And your action at this stage cannot be said to have been reckless and not thought out, taking into account the fact that we had that situation before. And as for IRBA, I think for me, Comrade Chair, the least said the better, because I really don't see what value add they have beyond mere statutory processes. Thirdly, comrades, it's important to remember AXA is a Chapter 9 institution. I was just going through the Constitution, what it says. So in as much as they account to Parliament, but their independence is sacrosanct, meaning their ability to take action and make decisions must always be respected. Yes, we want accountability in terms of explain, let us understand. But at the end of the day, the decision remains theirs. Fourthly, I think, comrades, we need to separate the two elements. With KPMG, you have a problem of a breakdown in risk management as well as audit practice. Now, if you can't manage your risks, if your audit practices are questionable or suspect, then clearly there is no audit outcome or report that you're going to give that will inspire confidence from anybody. And I think that's, for me, that's a very, very serious issue. Now, with Konki, my understanding is I really don't understand, and maybe it was not your place, AG, to talk to these things, but I really don't understand how the leadership of Koki can say there was a transaction, because I remember the lady who left, right, sold their shares to somebody, but the identity of this person is unknown. It's 2 years down the line. We are the leadership of Konki, but we don't know who are these new shareholders. I think if there's anything there's nothing more you can say to discredit yourself. Either to appear as a clown or to actually appear as a crook. At best, you will appear as a clown, but at worst, you are a crook. How does it happen? 2 years down the line, you are the leadership of the institution. You don't know who are the shareholders. then we bring in the issues of transformation. And unfortunately for me, I'm talking as an Africanist, so there's no one who can claim to have a far-left position that I do. You see, for me, comrades, the fundamental question is, people are black when they want contracts. But we never ask, what is black about you beyond your skin? What black agenda do you have? So here you have a black person who sells shares to an unknown entity. You have these black leaders of Konki who 2 years down the line say, we don't know who are the shareholders. And we have to stand up and say, this is a black firm. How do we know? So I think we, and it appears to be a trap, Comrade Chair, that we've fallen into, you know, of talking transformation from a liberal point of view that seeks to perpetuate the notion that transformation is about assisting incompetent, perpetually incompetent black people who deserve a standard grade form of appraiser. They should not be held to the highest standards, to good standards, because anyway they're black, so even if they make mistakes, they do what understand for the sake of transformation. So transformation is about inferiority. That is a classical liberal approach, you know, friends of the natives kind of philosophical approach. And yet for me, when we're fighting apartheid, we said we had higher values, you know, higher visions, meaning that our actions, our thinking was superior to that of the enemy, and therefore our way of doing things beyond 94 must actually reflect that superiority. How things then fall back to inferiority and want to justify that and explain that away. For me, as an Africanist, as a liberated, mentally African, I find that insulting. How do we even come here and talk about Konki when you have people who just can't, I mean, their contracts are at stake and they can't answer. I don't want to talk about VBS. We did the same. And the moment the facts come out, you want to hide under the table. Of course, yes, they're black, but the kind of, and they're professionals, but the kind of things they do, it's almost like they're semi-literate. So I think that it is good, Comrade, that the AG is here. He has spoken, he has given the facts. And if anybody has a problem with the facts, then you can't assist such people. If you have problems with the facts, there's nothing we can do to assist you. And lastly, the temptation was there, AG, to say, how do we, you know, what Comrade Kuno was raising. Because that's the cry that I think we've raised with you informally, that entities that are not audited by the Auditor General, everything is fine. Look at the SABC. The issue around irregular expenditure, which is the basis of their qualification, only came up when your office came in. Otherwise, all along it was fine. Which then raises the question that all the audit reports that we get that have not been done by the Auditor General, there will always be a question mark. And I do think that in terms of how we move forward, we can obviously try and work out a number of scenarios, and not just either or. You know, and I think this good example that we're talking about now, where you contract in KPMG to go and do the work, but you do the quality checks and it comes out in your name. I look at it as an alternative to you hiring staff and doing it directly, or doing Section 34 where the auditees themselves hire. I think there can be an in-between route, because what we lack is your office quality check. You look at the reports from private firms in any report, it's so telegraphic, you can't use it for oversight. you look at the report of the Auditor General, it's very informative. So if Parliament is to do its oversight work and you are to assist in that process, I think, Comrade Chair, those are some of the conversations that can be held going forward. But I think, as always, the AG's office has given a very comprehensive and good explanation of what has happened, which I think has given all of us comfort that there was nothing arbitrary and there was actually no other decision you could have taken than the one that you took. Thanks, Comrade.
Thanks, Comrade Gordy. Chair, AG, from my side, just 2 points. I mean, perhaps start with the point raised by Honourable Dubazan. I speak under correction, but I think IRBA reports to the Standing Committee of Finance. So if we think they must come and account to Parliament, maybe we should interact with Yunus Karim and company. I don't know that it would be prudent for us to call them directly to our committee. I just wanted to deal with that, notwithstanding everything else that was said by Comrade Gordy. And maybe just to reemphasize that indeed Chapter 9 of the Constitution says that the AG is independent, subject only to the Constitution, and that he or she or the office must perform without fear, favor, or prejudice. That's what the Constitution says. And our role as COAG is to ensure that that happens. And that is why we call you AG. We're not going to cover up for incompetency from your side, but we will forever defend you or your independence, not the person, but the independence of the performance of the AG. And I thought it was important that we say that. And it doesn't just say that Parliament must interfere. It says nobody must interfere with the operations of the AG. I also want to say, and maybe be a bit more harsher than Honourable Gordy, and say to you, AG, until Nkonki declares who the shareholders are, they must be barred from doing any business with taxpayers' money. You'll account to us if you do anything different. So let there be no grey areas. Until we know who the shareholders are, if you do any business with them, AG, it's the one time where you will be at risk of the wrath of SCOAC. So that is clear. I think we must make it as clear as that. We can't have a situation where we don't know who you're doing business with. It just doesn't work. So I thought I must put that on the record and say, Nkonki better declare or they should. And everybody else that supports them, quite frankly, must know that this is our view. Until they declare that, I don't think they would support them. The one question that I want you to, as you wrap up, AG, or before I get there, let me just indicate that I think it's very clear that certainly SCOAG supports the move that you've taken. Nobody here has come out opposed to what you've done. I think, as Honourable Gordy said, your reputation is everything, and once that goes, then we might as well close up as the AG. The one question that I want to put as you wrap up, as I was coming here, I didn't get the name of the expert or analyst or whoever it was, but this individual was saying that because of what is happening with KPMG and the fact that South Africa contributes so little to KPMG as an international institution, there's a real risk of them withdrawing from South Africa. And that seemed to worry this individual, that they will withdraw because South Africa is such a small part of KPMG. Maybe you should comment on what are the risks or consequences if KPMG withdraws. I don't want to give my own views, but if whoever was saying this publicly this morning was correct that they would pull out, will you lose sleep over it? That's the question. Would you lose sleep over it? Not as the AG, but I'm talking about South Africa Incorporated, because there seems to be, or that's the sentiment that I got, that they could probably cut their losses and withdraw from South Africa? And what would the consequences be to the institution? If you could answer that. Other than that, AG, thank you very much for, one, appearing. I must say to South Africa and also to colleagues who know that I made one phone call to the AG and he was willing to come and do it. So it's not a planned meeting. This was a special meeting. So thanks, AG, for stopping everything else that you were doing to come to us. We appreciate it. And, yeah, you've got our support broadly. You've got our support. And it's then for us to defend it wherever it needs to be defended. I'm going to hand over to you, AG, and give you exactly 5 minutes. And at 10 past, oh, you want more than 5 minutes? Do you want more? Okay, we'll give you until 4:15. And at exactly at 4:15, we will adjourn this meeting, but we'll give you until 4:15, AG, to say whatever you need to say, and we will then adjourn. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair, and once again, we are humbled as the office to hear the type of sentiments that you express. We, Chair, are going to continue doing the work that we have been entrusted with by this Parliament and the Constitution of the country. As I said earlier on, if anybody was wondering out there why such a step was necessary, it could possibly help to summarize it by saying we were trying to avert the prospect of a frightening possibility from becoming our horrendous reality. I think that's really the summary of it for us. We thought, let us try and avert this frightening possibility of the audit office being dragged through its name into issues of lack of trust, and we thought that let's avert that from becoming our horrendous reality. So we'd like to also thank the staff in our office for demonstrating the support, the commitment, the understanding. And we know that as painful as this may be to some, but we believe that it is also broadly in the context of restoring the credibility and trust of the auditing profession in general. And that's why we will reach out from here on to those that we work with in the private sector as well as in our own office to say there are few things that you can do to disrupt what an audit office is about. And if you tamper with the area of independence, if you tamper with the area of executing the work with professional competence that comes with ethics, then it does not matter how much the fee is. So on that note, Chair, let me quickly try and see whether I understood your question regarding the risk of withdrawal from SA. If I can just hazard an answer to this and say KPMG International is an international brand that operates like other brands in the Big Four in big markets. People who exercise risk as clients, as owners of capital, as other stakeholders, whether it is citizens or others, in some other societies, because of the robustness of the inquiries as well as the actions that get taken, they will not escape asking the question about your South African part of the brand. I think that's the context that person who was talking about this matter on TV this morning was alluding to. You will not escape it. And because they've got a big multi-billion operation globally as the firm, it starts eating into, shall I say, their lunch, as more and more of the troubles confronting their South African practice confront them. Which means that if they have a decision and they've got the branding rights to protect that flow of value for themselves as well as in the areas where they operate. It will be easier for them if they decided to have nothing to do with that place that gets us to answer for things that we were not responsible for, kind of answer. So that, I think that is the context in which that risk is. And what it will mean? It will mean exactly what many commentators have been saying over the last couple of weeks and months, that suddenly now the big players, if you look at all our banks, for example, we've got a multiplicity of them. And because of the regulations that come with the South African Reserve Bank in terms of audit and oversight arrangements for these firms, you suddenly have a limited number from which you could choose who you want your audit service provider to be. And I think that's where the issue of the market concentration risk comes from, whereby suddenly now you'll have fewer firms to choose from. While you are trying to choose that firm that you've evaluated in terms of their capacity, you'll possibly discover that they are conflicted because they are responsible for another financial institution's activities, which is a competitor to this particular financial institution that wants to appoint them as an auditor. So they will say, no, we can't appoint this firm A because there's competitive information that they have access to in respect of their responsibilities for another banking institution that also is audited and serviced by them. So the lesser they are, the firms, to do the work, the more risky it becomes also to the users of that information as well as the players in the market. So, but I think the reality, Chair, if one looks at it, in an environment where we've got the multiplicity of risks as we are experiencing them currently and going into the future, the ideal situation is that you do not want less numbers of these people who can do this kind of work, considering the journey that it takes to get them to a stage of fruition. Because many of those that are there at entry level have not yet matured to the point where they now have it in their system, the whole rigor of an audit. So it can cause some disruption, it can cause some turbulence, because people will be trying to do stuff that they are not yet or ready to deal with, because some of these interfaces and these interrelationships between what happens here and their relationships with other global firms sometimes is the tricky part that other people might confront. But it's a journey, Chair. If you think about it, not maybe 20 years or so ago, there used to be the big eight in the South African context, until many have merged to become what we know today as the likes of Deloitte, the likes of PwC, the likes of KPMG and EY. But there used to be many firms broader than just that big four standing up or rather becoming the major providers in the market. But as things grow, as these companies internationalize and get involved in many other activities, they started getting choosy among others in terms of who they can get as their auditors. So it's a big discussion, I guess, that even today in the paper, many of the commentators are raising subjects of this nature. And I think that because who gets affected at the end, if one looks at all of this when it happens, and whoever the firm that audits, whoever, ultimately the public, the people that have put their investments in some vehicles and all of that, if there's a big risk around those investments where they've put their money, the chances are that their hard-earned retirement money might not see them for too long after retirement, among other broader societal consequences. Hence, I think that the conversation about this matter in terms of what happens to it as well as what happens to the profession ought to be embraced, not only because we as an audit office have got a stake in it, but because all of us have got a stake in that overall governance system for the country. Thanks very much.
One announcement. Honourable members, we meet Tuesday at 9. AG, Cindy will send out the notices later. We didn't want to send them out because we thought it will confuse. But AG, we on Tuesday getting a report back on the Public Audit Act from whoever else, and we'll start deliberating as committee. And we will get that report back from the legal and the researchers and start deliberating, and we are hoping, AG, that we would be able to finalize that by the 22nd, 23rd of June, I think. 22nd of May, round about there, we're hoping to
to do it. So, honourable members, we're going to have quite a harsh time between now and then, because we want to pass it by the 22nd of May. So, AG, I think you've been invited, certainly have been invited, and Treasury to come and give us report back. And see you then on Tuesday. And honourable members, you'll get your notifications on Tuesday. And to our friends from the media and everybody else, thank you so much. The meeting is adjourned.